So I'm Matt Mite. I'm a first year professor at the University of Utah. And for my lecture series, I'll be telling you about control flow analysis of higher order programs. And you know, I really liked the way Olivier started off with some quotes. And I remember there's an important quote from the history of CFA theory from Olin. So back when Olin was a graduate student at CMU and introducing CFA theory to the world at PLDI, he you know, went up to the stage, jumped on stage, and then he said, "I'm on a mission from God." Said, and his mission was to tell the world that CFA was in fact easy, that it was useful, and that it's deep. So by easy, I hope to be able to, you know, and this is really my mission today too. I hope to convince you by the end of these three lectures that it's not that hard to implement CFA or control flow analysis for higher order programs. That with sufficient caffeine, I think any of you could accomplish it within about a day. Secondly, that it's useful. It's a lot of caffeine. There's an existence proof that it can be done. I'll put it that way. And by that it's useful, I mean that it can help you in optimizing and parallelizing and securing programs. And by deep, I mean if you're, you know, starting out as a PhD student, there's a lot of work left to be done. You know, if you're scratching around for a topic, come talk to me sometime or just pay attention to the lectures. There's a lot of stuff you can do. So, you know, and my course critiques last semester, they criticized me for not providing a detailed outline at the start of my lectures because I didn't use slides. So here's my detailed outline for this talk or this whole lecture series. I'll cover the background for CFA theory. Then we'll look at methods. So this isn't, you know, the structure of the three talks. The bulk of what we'll be doing is just methods. And then I'll be covering applications mostly on the last day. And for today, we'll do background and then three different ways to do zero CFA. We'll do constraints, types, and then abstract interpretation. Tomorrow, we're going to take a look at the CFA bestiary. So there's, you know, at least a dozen different CFAs out there. So we'll look at some of the more useful ones. You know, CFA is really all about fitting, you know, the right analysis to your specific domain. And so you really have to know all the ones that are out there to get it right. And then on Monday, we'll look at applications of all this stuff and what lies beyond. So for background, you know, this talk is about the control flow analysis of higher order programs. So what's a higher order program? Anybody? What's the definition of a higher order program?
Program with functions that take other functions and tidy them.
Okay, that's half of it. What's the other half?
They can return the function.
There you go. Yeah. And I know that's true because I checked Wikipedia. Yeah. But I'm more concerned with static analysis of higher order programs. So the question I really want to ask is, what makes it difficult to analyze higher order programs? So there's a lot of correct answers to this question. Why is it hard to analyze higher order programs? Any thoughts? What makes it hard to reason about their behavior?
Well, the main thing is that the particular function that might be associated with an identifier can change over the lifetime of the program runs, so you can't do the normal interpretation that you do with comparative programs.
Absolutely. You look at a higher order call site, you have no idea what's being called there. So there's, you know, any other thoughts? I mean, there's a lot of answers to this question for why it's hard. But there's a phrase that comes up over and over and over again anytime you see somebody rediscovering the higher order control flow problem. And when you see this phrase, you can practically predict that they're about to reinvent zero CFA for whatever domain they're working in. So, you know, I was at VMchi and I heard this, and then I knew I was about to see zero CFA reconstructed for x86 assembler, and sure enough, that's exactly what they did. When you see the phrase, data flow depends on control flow, and control flow depends on data flow, you know they're talking about the inherent hardness of the higher order control flow problem. Because you really have to do both of these things at the exact same time to figure out what the heck a higher order program is doing. Yeah, but why is higher order analysis really hard? Which particular kinds of it make this such a difficult problem to solve? You know, because there are higher order languages where the higher order control flow analysis is not all that difficult. And then there are ones where it's incredibly hard. So does anybody have any ideas for, you know, what particular feature makes higher orderness hard? Unless you've done a lot of CFA theory, you probably don't know the answer. But anybody want to venture a guess? Well, in my experience, what it comes down to is a higher order language that allows a value to be not only code, but code bound to dynamically allocated data. So C, for instance, will allow you to pass around function pointers, but it doesn't allow you to pass around closures. So you know, modulo, you know, the difficulty of analyzing pointer arithmetic and unions and all the other stuff for C, the higher order aspect of C is not that difficult to handle. You can take a standard interprocedural alias analysis, extend it a little bit, and you can have some sort of higher order control flow analysis. But when you have code, like a lambda term, mixed with dynamically allocated data, like an environment, now it's harder. Because you can have an arbitrary number of environments arising at the runtime. And you know, when you're dealing with a static analysis, you're always dealing with some sort of like finite abstract state space. And so ultimately, you run into the pigeonhole problem. You've got to somehow manage the way these appear. And how you manage them depends on the kind of precision you're going to get back. But when you think about it, objects also have this property. You know, an object is a class, which you know, contains lots of code. And it's a record describing the values of the fields. So all the stuff I'm going to show you for analyzing you know, higher order functional programs ports directly and immediately over to object-oriented programs. And in fact, I will construct KCFA for Java just to show you that this is exactly the case. I will literally alpha rename an abstract state space from lambda calculus and get an abstract state space for Java. So when I think of higher order languages, I think of languages not only like Lisp and Scheme and ML and Haskell, but I also think of stuff like Java and C++. To me, they all have the same inherent hardness in reasoning about what they do. So control flow analysis. Just to clear up some terminology, I think, by the way, control flow analysis, or CFA, or whatever you want to call it, is perhaps the most poorly named topic in all programming languages, because it doesn't actually describe what a CFA really does at the end of the day. But there's at least five different ways people refer to control flow analysis. We talk about control flow analysis of higher order programs, higher order control flow analysis, closure analysis, and CFA. All of these basically mean the same thing wherever you see them. And the fundamental problem you're trying to solve with a higher order control flow analysis is, given some call site, some higher order call site, you know, where you've got F applied to some arguments E1 through N, what is F? Or really, what could F be? And if you want to recast this as an object-oriented program problem, you can think about a method invocation. And in this case, you've got some method N that you're invoking on O, and you want to know what objects could O be. And just to give you a sense of you know, why this is hard, and we touched on this a little bit earlier, there's really two ways that F can get bound. You know, you can bind it directly, if you're lucky. In this case, you know, F is basically first order. We know exactly what it is, and it's not hard to tell. But there are those cases where F is argument bound. And when F is argument bound, what F ultimately is depends on where this lambda term gets used. Because wherever it gets used, that's going to add more values into what F could be. Now, to get a little more specific, let's take a look at another example. So here's a you know, classic higher order function, apply. Apply just takes two arguments, applies the first to the second. So what ends up flowing into F is going to depend entirely upon how apply gets used. So if we have some function H, and we end up passing H into apply, assuming this apply gets invoked somewhere, then in the flow set for F, we're going to find H. Now, if this apply appears inside the body of some function G, and G ends up getting passed into apply, then H is in the flow set for F because G was in the flow set for F. So you get these sort of recursive dependencies on how stuff gets in there. And of course, with higher order programs, you can get arbitrarily nasty control flow in just four expressions. That's all it really takes. So this is all the control flow patterns you'll see arising from this expression right here. So that's some background on CFA. We ought to, before we get too far, ask ourselves, why compute it at all? You know, like Olivier said, you have to figure out why you want to know how to do something like this. And for me, the number one reason really comes down to the 80-20 rule. So there's, I guess it's like a folk theorem in compilers. I hear this all the time, that, 20% of the optimizations, really just three of them, give you 80% of the benefits. And the other 20% give you, the other 80% give you the last 20% of the benefit. And the three optimizations I keep hearing from really hardcore compiler people are that inlining procedures, constant propagation and folding, and register allocation is where you get the bulk of your performance improvements from an optimization. And if you can't do a higher order control flow analysis, if you can't unravel a control flow problem, you can't do a very good job on any of these in a higher order language. So if you want to optimize a higher order language and make it run at a reasonable speed, you're going to have to do CFA. And actually, if you've never played with Milton or Stalin, so Stalin's a scheme compiler, Milton's an ML compiler, both of them use CFA, and they're by far the fastest I know of out there, in large part because they do this deep static analysis. They're able to do a lot of optimizations that other compilers just can't do. Yeah. And there's a lot of other stuff you might want to do. And not all of it is necessarily related to optimization. You know, so people started getting into model checking higher order programs, and control analysis is obviously very important there. If you don't know what's being called, it's really hard to predict what's going to happen next. And then there's a lot of other optimizations. Like if you really want to squeeze all the performance out of your compiler, you've got to go to that last 80% and get all the optimizations in. So there's a lot of stuff you can do with a CFA. So what technically is a control flow analysis? Well, technically, all a control flow analysis is answering is, given a call site, give a conservative bound on the set of procedures which could be invoked there. That's technically all a control flow analysis is doing. Of course, to actually answer this question, you have to do what really is a value flow analysis. I mean, if you want to answer it well. And if you want to do a good value flow analysis, of course, you have to answer the control flow analysis question too. And a value flow analysis is trying to conservatively bound the set of values which could come out of any expression, not just the procedures. So Fritz Heinlein is always, I think he's trying to rename the field. He always calls it VFA, as far as I can tell, because I think he feels passionately that that's what we're really doing. And in fact, it is. But Olin chose CFA, so we're sort of stuck with it. And just to give you an example of the kind of precision you can get back from a control flow analysis, I would really lump them into three categories, and really this one's a range. So when you're lucky, you get back a precise answer. It can tell you that at some particular call site, what you're invoking is the function that adds 8 to its argument. You can't always hope to get that level of precision, but sometimes you can. The most popular level of precision is to get some sort of approximation over the lambda terms. So this is what something like a zero CFA will do. And it won't tell you which functions are being invoked, but it will tell you the lambda terms over which the functions being invoked at that call site are closed. So that's what something like this is telling you. It's saying, at this particular call site, you might be invoking a closure over this lambda term, or you might be invoking a closure over this lambda term. This one adds z, and I don't know what z is. This one multiplies by z, and I don't know what z is here either. Now, with more advanced control flow analyses, you can try to actually get a set of real functions out of it. So it is possible to know that it's some function, it's a family of functions, or it's a set of functions, all of them add something, and you might even be able to figure out that they all add an even number. That's actually within the realm of possibilities for more advanced CFAs. And the real point of talking about levels of precision is to point out once again just how much environment matters. So if you don't have any free variables, there's only one function you're talking about, and you can be very precise. When you have free variables, the number of functions which could be invoked there, if you're not tracking the environment very carefully, is infinite. And it's also worth asking, why take the time to learn the mechanics of CFA itself? And so if you go to my research group's website, ucombinator.org, you can download a public implementation of CFA. It's for a fairly generic, higher order intermediate language, and you can just run it yourself without worrying about what the details of CFA are. But I don't think that's going to do anybody a whole lot of good unless they're trying to do some sort of rudimentary optimization. If you want to do anything deeper with the analysis, then you're really going to have to understand and modify the CFA yourself. There is this paradigm in optimization for higher order languages which said, what you do with a higher order language is you run the CFA on it, and then you turn it into a first order analysis. The problem with that attitude, which works reasonably well for optimization, is that there's so much precision lost by the time you've done your higher order control flow analysis that you may not be able to run the analysis you may not be able to run the first order analysis at the level of precision that you actually need. So you really do have to understand the mechanics of CFAs and modify the CFAs themselves. You need to actually weave whatever your analysis is into the CFA if you want to get a reasonable level of precision. And the nice thing is, as you weave your analysis into a CFA, the precision of the CFA will also get better. They will feed on each other. So for just a sort of a crude history of all the things we're going to talk about, so a lot of people think that Olin Shivers is the one that invented higher order control flow analysis, which is not strictly the case. He did invent the first practical and reasonably precise and robust higher order control flow analysis, but in terms of a computable static analysis that worked with lambda expressions, I think Neil Jones had the first back in 1981. Now, no one has ever implemented this analysis because its results, precision-wise, are not significantly different from top, and its complexity appears to be exponential. So, but he technically had the first. You know, back in 1988, when Olin was on his mission from God, you know, he announced the zero CFA, which is, you know, cubic time, reasonably precise, and reasonably robust higher-order control flow analysis. For his dissertation in 1991, he came up with the KCFA hierarchy, and the perhaps most widely studied level of that hierarchy is 1CFA, which is the first context-sensitive higher-order control flow analysis. There's a little-known gem of a CFA that even a lot of CFA experts don't know about this, called a quality-based or a quality CFA, or, you know, I think first time I actually called it closure analysis or something like that. But, it's actually a linear time CFA. You can implement it in the parser, and it gives you reasonably robust results, but almost nobody knows about it. But I'll show it to you because it's actually not that difficult to understand. In 1995, Jens Paulsberg sort of rephrased CFA theory in terms of constraints. And after that, everybody started working in the constraint-based paradigm, where primarily before that, people had been working with abstract interpretation. And this really colored the, the flavor of the research that people were doing afterwards. You know, because I think for the following decade, what people were playing around with was different values of K, where K is not just numbers, but also, you know, different ways of doing what K essentially does. And this is you know, where what I call the CFA bestiary comes from. So, when you're trying to figure out which control flow analysis you need for your program, you're going to be looking into research from this particular period. But by and large, what people were doing in that point in time was just toying around with the speed and the precision of CFAs. All along, Olin had been wanting to do, better in terms of power, particularly with respect to analyzing environments. In 2006, we published our first result in that area, called environment analysis. And so that's, my new agenda and Olin's new agenda going forward is to actually get much more precise in our reasoning about environments so that we can actually change the kinds of questions we can ask and hope to get a realistic answer back from a CFA. And if you're just starting out doing research in the field, there's two very recent publications which you definitely want to know about. So Olivier's student, Jan Mittgaard, published a fantastic exhaustive review of all the CFA literature out there. Literally everything is in there. There's 171 entries in the bibliography alone. So if you're trying to get the speed really fast on what's out there, I definitely recommend this piece of work. And this one's one day old. David Van Horn defended his dissertation yesterday. And it's an exhaustive review of a lot of the CFAs out there in terms of complexity analysis. So, we sort of hypothesized that, one CFA seems to be exponential, zero CFA seems to be cubic. David Van Horn pinned a lot of this stuff down, but his dissertation is also just, a beautiful gem that gives you a great description of all this stuff. Among the things he proved in there was that stuff like KCFA for K greater than zero is exponential time complete. And he also, and this is a real surprise, he proved this with Jan Mittgaard, is that KCFA for years was assumed to be cubic, and he actually showed it's cubic over log n. So it's not a substantial boost in practice, but it is still interesting. So there's four broad classes of techniques you can use to do higher order control flow analysis. I think what most compilers do is ad hoc techniques, which you might summarize as just pattern matching on code. They're looking for certain ways of or certain code constructs, and they say, okay, if we see this construct or this pattern, we know this is the flow behavior. It's not particularly rigorous, but there are some reasonably effective ad hoc techniques out there, and it's worth knowing about them. You can go a long way with just ad hoc techniques. Then there's the constraint-solving paradigm and a type-based analysis paradigm. And the constraint-solving paradigm and the type-based paradigm are more or less the same. It's just, different ways of phrasing the same sort of stuff. But what I'll spend most of my time on is abstract interpretation, or the abstract interpretive approach to higher-order control flow analysis. I'm only going to carve out the little chunk of CFA or of abstract interpretation that I need and let Patrick Couzeau do the rest. But this is definitely the most flexible, powerful, universal framework that I know of for doing higher-order control flow analysis. So on to ad hoc techniques. So like I said, what these techniques do is you look at a piece of code, you say, okay, is this a pattern I know about in some sense? Can I figure anything out about it? And the simplest ad hoc technique is what I would call null CFA. So if I cover up the rest of a program and I point to a call site and I ask you, what could F be? What is always a safe answer?
Any function.
Exactly. Top. You can always say top. And a lot of compilers do this. So that's null CFA. And you know, if you don't need full analysis, null CFA is just fine. But you can do better than that. So suppose I point to a call site, say, we've got some function of type T being applied to argument X. What could F be now? Can you give me a better answer than top? Yeah, just functions of type T. If it's subtype T prime, it can't flow here, assuming you have type soundness. So any function with type T. There's another one called arity CFA. So if I point to a call site and say, what functions might actually get invoked here? What could they be? All functions of arity 3. Yeah. Yeah, it depends on the language. Okay, yeah. So yeah, be careful with this one. It does change based on the language. And here's one that it's effectively an arity CFA, except it works incredibly well in practice. So my PhD sibling, Lex Spoon, used this particular technique to scale CFA to levels previously unheard of. But it only works on Smalltalk. So if you're looking in Smalltalk and you have some call site like life set meaning 42, you can ask, what is set meaning? So how many of you actually use Smalltalk, by the way? Okay, so you three will have to answer this question. yeah. What answer can you give? What's the default answer you can give in Smalltalk that you really can't do in other languages very easily? Well, because Smalltalk is keyword-based, and because programmers just happen to use wildly different keywords for most every time they create one, you get reasonably precise answers if you just search through all the code out there and figure out everything that's figure out every object that has set meaning or a set meaning method like this. And so, what Lex did was he would run a robust CFA like a KCFA for starters, and then as it became clear that it was going to become intractable to solve the problem, he would start pruning it at sort of arbitrarily defined depths. I mean, he empirically derived, when you want to start pruning, and then he would fall back on this. And he was able to get into hundreds of thousands of lines of code. I'm sure today he could get to millions of lines of code quite easily for Smalltalk. So sometimes these ad hoc techniques work remarkably well. And it's also kind of interesting that, the language design here actually influenced how well you could analyze it. And actually, it goes beyond language design. It's also a matter of, coding practice culture, because the way you write Smalltalk influenced how people chose names for keywords, and that enabled Lex to actually do better control flow analysis. And this one, is this probably the simplest one, is just walk over the code and look for where you have first order instances of functions. If you see this, F is first order. You don't have to ask any questions about what it is. You just know. And this sounds simple, but you can get embarrassingly good results out of first-order closure analysis if you combine it with something like monomorphization. So if you go through all of your let-bound lambda terms and you inline all of them all over the code, and then you run this analysis, you actually get really good results. I mean, some places you get top, but in a lot of places you can really narrow it down. It's because a lot of the time the way you invoke higher orderness is it's some library procedure like fold or map. When all those get inlined, the flow sets, it becomes obvious what's going into each individual invocation most of the time. Not always, but if you've got to get some level of CFA precision in a hurry, this is not bad. But if you can't handle top ever, then you're going to have to go with something more robust. So I think the standard answer to doing something robust and reasonably efficient is zero CFA. And zero CFA is, I think, by far the most implemented control flow analysis out there at this point. Maybe poly CFA has been implemented near it, but by and large, what people go with is zero CFA. And again, zero CFA is terribly named. If I had to pick a new name for zero CFA, I wouldn't call it zero CFA. I'd call it lambda flow analysis. Because philosophically, that's exactly what's happening with zero CFA. And what I mean by that is that the fundamental approximation that zero CFA makes is it takes the data component of the value, which is an environment or a record, and it throws it away. It says, I'm going to abstract closures into lambda terms and objects just into classes. And once you do this, it's actually quite easy to come up with the mechanics of how lambdas flow. So let's just look at a call site here and reason about how things flow through it. So we've got some expression E1 applied to E2. And we're told that lambda v.eb flows into the function position, and some value flows into the argument position. We know one more thing now. What do we know about where else this value flows? Exactly. So we know it's also going to go into the argument of v1. And we can represent this as a reasonably straightforward constraint. So this constraint is saying, if we have a lambda term that flows to the function position and a value that flows to the argument position, this value will also end up in the flow set for the variable. So this flows to notation is, you know, somewhat standard across CFA theory, and all you're describing is what's called the flow set, or the set of values or expressions which could flow to a particular expression. So in this case, it's a map from expressions into sets of lambda terms. It's one way to think of what flows to is. So when a lambda term flows into a procedure position, we know one other thing when we figure out what can come out of that lambda term. What else do we know? If that value flows out of the body of the lambda term, where else is that value going to flow from? Exactly. It's going to flow out of the application. And we can represent this with another constraint. So if we know some lambda term flows to the function position, and some value flows to the body of the lambda term, this value also has to flow to this application point itself. And that's zero CFA. That's it. That's all you need. Well, plus this, you know, simple reflexive rule up here to get you started. So in three rules, you've got a robust high-order control flow analysis. And this is the version that Jens Paulsberg described in his 1995 paper, except he did it with subset inclusion constraints rather than the membership ones I was using. And there's a neat reason to, you know, encode these as subset inclusion constraints that I'll show you in a second. So, is that?
Could we go over that again?
Sure.
Could you say again what the meaning of flows to can map?
So flows to, see, is there a dry erase? I can write it on the board. You think of it, so it takes in an expression. What it gives you back is a set of lambda terms. And what it's saying is, at runtime, if you, you know, look at the value of this expression, it's going to be a closure over one of these lambda terms. You know, or you can also throw in, you know, numerals, constants, other stuff into flows to, and that's commonly done as well. But it's what flows to is telling you is what flows to that expression at runtime, or what could flow to that expression at runtime. So I guess going back to here. You know if this lambda term flows to here, this function position, and you've got a value flowing into this argument position, you know that the flow set for the variable, which is this thing right here, has to include that value. Yeah, so we're assuming it for the moment that value could be just lambda terms, but you can also have numeric constants, things like that in there. And again, if you can figure out what might flow to the body of this lambda term, that's what could get returned from any application of that lambda term. So we have to show that value also flows out of this application point as well. And that's what this constraint is saying right here. If you've got some lambda term flowing to the function position and some value flowing out of that lambda term from the body, returning from it, then it may also return from this application point. And so this is the signature on flows to. You can view it as a relation, you can view it as a function, but ultimately it's relating expressions to values, which in this case are lambda terms.
So maybe now is time for me to add my more general question about CFA.
Mm-hmm.
Is it known how it relates to standard analysis that we do in imperative languages, in all languages, like AVS analysis that Andre will talk to us about?
Yes, there are known relationships. So Andersen's is one of the standard alias analyses. That is effectively zero CFA. Are you familiar with Steensgaard?
Yeah, I'm familiar with those, but those are not cubic.
Andersen's not cubic?
I mean,
no, Steensgaard is definitely not cubic.
Okay.
Steensgaard is almost linear time. And Steensgaard and closure analysis, or equality-based CFA, are philosophically the same thing. Same complexity and do roughly the same thing.
For zero CFA, I can believe, but is there some analogy with one CFA, for instance?
So I mean, a lot of the terminology will carry over, and we can get into that, where they carry over. I was planning on doing that more towards the end of where the parallels were drawn. What's interesting to me is that things tend to show up in the functional community. About 4 years, they show up in the imperative community. So if you're looking for topics to mine out, look what's happening in the control flow analysis of functional languages, and look how to port that over to imperative or object-oriented languages. But the way you compute it with the constraints is, you initialize everything in the flows to relation to bottom, in the empty set. You just iterate to the fixed, and you iterate to a fixed point. You keep applying those constraints until nothing changes. And it's worth, going through an example to see exactly where the precision in something like zero CFA starts to break down, or just to at least understand its limitations. So if you're running a zero CFA on this code, yeah.
What is it about zero CFA that guarantees that the fixed point exists?
So first of all, the constraints are effectively monotonic, and you're also operating in sort of a finite space. So you're eventually going to hit. You'll either fill it all in, but you're not going to sort of chaotically iterate through that space. So when you see the abstract interpretive version of zero CFA, it's easier to see how zero CFA can be phrased in terms of a monotonic function operating over the flows to relation.
The monotone was pretty easy to see. It was the size of the space.
So you're not convinced that the state space is finite?
No.
Okay. Well, so the state space is effectively the flows to relation. You can think of it as a big table, and on one side of the table you have expressions, and on the top of the table you have lambda terms. There's a finite number of lambda terms. There's a finite number of expressions.
So it's fixed by the syntax.
Zero CFA fixes the state space to be finite. In fact, KCFA will also be finite state space. I don't actually know of any infinite state space CFAs out there. But I do agree that sometimes it can be tricky to see that the state space is in fact finite, particularly with KCFA. So if we go over this example right here, you'll get a feel for exactly how zero CFA thinks and where it can break down. So running this the constraints can fire in any order. I'm going to fix an order just for the sake of walking through this example. So first it's going to see this lambda term, the identity function, flowing into ID. So the flows to set of ID now contains the identity function. It then sees, this, because ID is here and here, that the identity function will flow to here and to here. Now, because the identity function flows to here, it sees 3 getting bound to X. So we have to update the flow set for X to include 3. Now, at this point, it sees 3 could be returned from X, this lambda term, because it returns X, could return 3, which means we have to update what this lambda term or what this application point could return to include 3. So we're going to say the flows to set of the identity function applied to 3 includes 3. Now, if it bothers you that I haven't introduced a lambda calculus with the numbers in it, but I'm using them, you can think of these things as 3 and 4 as lambda terms. That doesn't matter. And then, of course, it's going to see 3 flowing from this application point into V1. And then it's going to start to consider the effect of the second application of ID. So here it sees the identity function applied to 4, which means 4 can now flow into X. So we have to update the flow set for X to contain 4. Now, once the flow set for X gets updated to contain 4, we see that this particular application point can return whatever that lambda term can return. Whatever that lambda term can return is whatever X can be. So now we have to update the flow set for ID 4 to be both 3 and 4. And then, of course, it sees that flow set move into V2, so the flow set for V2 is also 3 and 4. But we're not done. We can still keep applying these constraints. We can keep iterating towards a fixed point. Because we have a pathway from the 4 into the return point of ID3 and into V1. So both of those flow sets will also be updated to include 4. So zero CFA, even though it was within his vocabulary to say that it returned just 4, got it wrong. Said it could return 3 or 4. But the answer included the actual answer. 0CFA is conservative in that regard. But this just gives you an idea of how imprecise 0CFA is, and what kind of compromises it makes to reach the precision it gets. Now, I have to mention this equality-based CFA because so few people know about it, and it rarely ever gets used. I can't name a single compiler that uses it, whereas lots of compilers use Steensguard, and they're more or less the same thing philosophically. And to get from the constraint-based 0CFA into this equality-based 0CFA, you just take these subset inclusion relations and change them into equality. And now it looks basically the same. And to compute this, I've seen lots of different ways that you can actually do it. You can walk over the parse tree, and what you're essentially doing is you're partitioning up all the expressions in the program into these equivalence classes, and you're joining them together with union find. And anything in the same equivalence class could flow in either direction to one or the other. And the nice thing about it is it's almost linear time, or linear time times inverse Ackermann to compute this analysis.
So you're saying that this is like Steensguard?
Yeah, it's
the previous thing is like Anderson.
Exactly, yeah. So the constraint-based versions I just put up were not flow-sensitive. You can add more to the constraints to make them flow-sensitive, but the ones I put up were not flow-sensitive. Are you disagreeing with that?
So the order.
If you add more constraints, which affects the order in which constraints can fire, it definitely will change the results, and it will definitely increase the complexity of the analysis. There's no question about that. Okay.
We will consider it again because I don't know exactly how to express the order. Or, for instance, if I have a conditional in there, how to express it. But it seems to me that even for 0CFA, you do take that into account.
So for 0CFA, you can take conditionals into account, or you can just assume you go both directions every time. And these will give you different kinds of 0CFAs. I mean, you can do either one. But yeah, they will give you very different analyses, and the complexities will be different. But most people, when they do 0CFA, don't take conditionals into account. They just go both directions.
How about 1CFA?
Again,
so the performance result, the x-time completeness of 1CFA, is that with flow sensitivity or not?
That's without flow sensitivity.
Without.
That's very constraint-based, flow-insensitive 1CFA.
And that's for instance, basically.
I think people had started to feel that KCFA was going to be exponential time, and now it's been proven.
But, I mean, that's surprising in terms of mapping points to an algorithm. Context-sensitive, flow-insensitive algorithm with one context is exponential.
Yeah, and also, I mean, there are some differences in the way people in the alias analysis community and the higher order community think about context. I think some of the context-sensitive algorithms in the alias analysis community would be considered context-insensitive to the higher-order community. We can get into that stuff later on.
I promise to never sidetrack you for the rest of your three.
No, this is good. Yeah.
I got it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. This one? Why did flow 2 ID 4 include 3? It included 3 because 3 flowed into X. So X can flow out of this lambda term as a return value, right? You believe that?
Yep.
Okay. This lambda term, which returns 3, supposedly, flows to here as well. So 0CFA says, whatever this lambda term can return, I'm going to assume I can return that as well. So 3 is in there, so it's going to assume that ID4 can also return 3. Yeah, I mean 0CFA is not necessarily a very intelligent analysis, but it's sacrificing precision to get speed. That's what 0CFA is trying to do. Does that answer your question, or are you still confused? Okay. Yeah, and maybe part of it is that ZeroCFA has to be monotonic. You can't ever decrease the flow sets. Once you add something into the flow set, you can't take it out. Otherwise, the complexity could get significantly worse. It's definitely context insensitive, yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to avoid terms like context insensitive and sensitive and stuff like that for today. I'm going to get into all that stuff tomorrow when we get into KCFA. Yeah, and this ZeroCFA is also flow insensitive. It's flow and context insensitive.
Meaning you could rearrange those statements and get the same answer?
Yeah, you could rearrange the statements, answer will stay the same. It will even evaluate dead code which can't possibly actually fire. It will still consider that when it's tabulating the flow results. Whereas some of the flow sensitive analyses can actually skip over dead code if they have that kind of information available to them. But one of the reasons I like this equality-based CFA is because it partitions the expressions in the program. You can assign a color to each partition. To represent zero CFA visually, you have to use all these arrows, and it gets kind of ugly to look at. At least with the quality-based CFA, you can assign all the partitions a color, and then you can sort of see how everything flows very easily. So clearly in here, we've got just two partitions. We've got a partition for the identity function, and then we've got a partition for 3 and 4. Yep?
Isn't this going to cause undesirable backflow?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. So, a quality-based CFA gives you horrible, horrible precision for some things. It's almost as bad as top, but it's fast. It will tell you if you don't think about anything else. If you don't look at what the term, and you say what can flow out of here. If you look at this, if you ask a quality based the CFA, it will say 4 can flow out of 3. It will say that. So if you're going to use an equality based CFA, combine it with the ad hoc techniques and sharpen it up as much as you can, because there's a lot of low hanging fruit left over after an equality based CFA runs. I think Heinz and McAllister have a demand-driven subcubic CFA that only works on typed programs, well-typed programs. So they do exist, but they're not common. I am actually working on a quadratic version of it's not zero CFA. It's a quadratic CFA that runs on GPUs and runs very fast on GPUs. So there's another one that'll be out at some point in the future. Yeah, it's quadratic. Yeah, it transforms, all of this lambda calculus into matrices and uses the GPUs to blast through the linear algebra. And the precision is somewhere between a quality-based CFA and zero CFA. So I know of at least one other thing that exists then. I would be irresponsible if I ignored type-based CFAs. So what I'll do is I'll just show you how to do zero CFA in a type-based setting. And really all you're doing here is translating the constraints into types. So what we're going to do is add types to our lambda calculus and labels to our lambda terms. So every lambda term now has a label on it. So we have a way to reference this particular lambda term. And the types for a simple, type-based full analysis are just sets of labels. So the type on a term tells you the set of lambda terms that may flow out of the evaluation, if you get a closure out of evaluating an expression, it's a closure over one of the lambda terms, in the type. That's what it's telling you. A lambda term flows to itself. And when you've got an application, this is really encoding the two other constraints, and this is sort of a weakening rule here. If you've got a function with flow set tau, so I'm going to read off the type rules using flow-based vocabulary. And you've got an argument of type tau prime, and you look up some lambda term that could be in tau, and you extend the type environment to have the argument be the flow set for the argument you're passing in here, then you better get back something that's compatible with the flow set for the return value itself. So it's just a rephrasing of the constraint-based rules in type-based form. Okay, so now what I'd like to do is do a little quick exercise. Let's see if we have time to actually do something like this. Yeah, I think we have time. So what I'd like people to do now, and this is going to be a sort of a reference point to see where all of you are in terms of understanding control flow analysis, is to type this term. So in other words, what I want you to do is figure out the type information for omega. And you don't have to use the type-based CFA. I don't expect you to actually memorize all those results. You can use your intuition, but pull out a piece of paper, write it down on a laptop, and try to figure out what belongs in each of these blanks. And the reason I picked omega is because it's kind of interesting. What could flow to every expression in this program? So go ahead and take 2 minutes to do that. I'll walk around and check on the results as you're going on. And then I'll show you the answer.
Are you doing zero CFA?
You can do any CFA you want. Just try to figure out what could flow to where in this particular program. And the reason is, it's because it's a divergent term, it's a little bit tricky. But this is how it would be. These are the flow sets for all the individual terms. So, the only place A actually flows is to itself. It's never going to actually get invoked at either of the other points. And B flows to all the Fs. If you think about it, this lambda term gets passed into here and then invoked on itself. So, B ends up here and here, and then it ends up here and here by the second time it's invoked. Now, because nothing ever comes out of here, the flow sets for the body, and the flow sets for every application expression, is the empty set. So it's actually possible to do very weak non-termination analysis with a CFA. It's nothing to get excited about, but you can actually do it. So for this, it's telling you that this program will diverge.
Abstraction, which I didn't follow fully. The type B there just means that the lambda that's labeled B, that entire expression can flow there.
Exactly. That's what it means. To be perfectly precise means a closure over that lambda expression can flow there.
But we're not distinguishing the flow.
Not with zero CFA. In other CFAs, it becomes more important. And if you've already got types in your program, then the way you can do a type-based flow analysis, and this is one thing I see mostly, is people just will add, a set of labels to every arrow. And then the function encodes not only the domain and the range, it's also encoding, which particular lambda terms take you from the domain to the range. And then the type rules look basically the same, except, we've changed the flow sets into this labeled arrow. I'm being a bit cynical here, but the only practical purpose I can think of for the type-based flow analysis stuff is if you're trying to get published in ICFP. If you take it from a constraint-based form or an abstract interpretive form and you rephrase it as a type-based analysis, it will actually increase your chances of getting published. I've seen this happen. So, but other than that, I can't think of many uses for it. So now we're going to get into what I call the small step CFA paradigm. And this is really the abstract interpretive CFA paradigm. And this is the one that I do the bulk of my work in. It's a modification of the original framework that Olin came up with. And the reason I like it is that it's just incredibly powerful, as you'll see. Very, very flexible as well. And also, the basic idea is pretty simple. So you start off with a concrete machine, some interpreter for some version of the lambda calculus. It's going to be a small step machine. Then you abstract it into a small step, finite state space abstract machine. And to run the flow analysis, what you end up doing is exploring the reachable states in the abstract tangential graph for this finite state machine. And that doesn't technically give you a full analysis, but you can extract the full analysis information from that. And what I like about it is that the implementation is easy. If you can implement a small step interpreter, you can implement a CFA. It's a universal framework in that by tweaking very small parameters, making very small changes, you get vastly different CFAs. You can get zero CFA, one CFA, any K CFA, poly CFA, all by changing one line of code. And another interesting advantage is that it makes total correctness the total soundness of the analysis easier to prove. So a major weakness in a lot of the constraint-based stuff is that a lot of published works involving constraint-based CFAs don't prove total correctness. They only prove partial correctness. So, and then they just sort of hand wave and say, but obviously it's correct for when the program is non-terminating as well. But I have found published work which took a constraint-based zero CFA and proved partial correctness where total correctness was not actually a consequent. You know, where I could find programs which were non-terminating, which would violate this extension to zero CFA. So, you know, correctness can become an issue. You do have to watch out for it. And you know, the way a small step machine works is you take your program and you convert it into a machine state. And then you've got some transition relation, which is atomically valuable, which takes you from one machine state to the next. And the meaning of your program, in this sense, is either the final state, if all you care about is a return value, but more often you take the meaning of the program to be all the states that you can reach along this path. And then when you're ready to do an abstract small step machine, you repeat the same process more or less. You take the program and you inject it into some initial abstract state. And then you explore some abstract transition relation beginning at that state. And the interesting thing about the abstract version is that it can be non-deterministic. It can fork, it can merge back together, and it can even loop back on itself. Now, generally, the abstract state space through which you're wandering is finite. So ultimately, you're going to run out of room to run, and your analysis will terminate. At least that's one way to think about executing an abstract interpretive CFA. That's not how it's actually done in practice, but you can think of it mentally as doing it that way. Of course, the missing ingredients is some sort of relation that tells us the relationship between the concrete states and the abstract states. This is what tells us that the analysis is sound. And what these relations are, and the property we have to prove about whatever relation we come up with is that if some concrete state is in a relationship with an abstract state, and we transition in the concrete, then that relationship is maintained with some subsequent abstract state as well. This is tying together, you know, the executions of the two machines for us. And in abstract interpretation, the way you typically come up with a relation like this is an abstraction function. So over here, you've got an infinite concrete state space. Over here, you've got a finite abstract state space. And an abstraction function is a map from this space into this space, the concrete into the abstract. And this is determining how the two are related modulo a lattice. And of course, when you go from an infinite space to a finite space, pigeonhole principle is definitely going to apply, and sometimes you get overlaps. So this state actually represents multiple concrete states. It's inevitable that some abstract states will represent multiple concrete states. It's lesser used when you're doing abstract interpretive CFAs, but there is also the inverse to the abstraction map called the concretization map, and what that does is if you give it an abstract state, it tells you the set of concrete states that it represents. So what you're really doing with a small step CFA is starting off at some point in your infinite state space, and you're injecting into the finite abstract state space, and then just exploring outward over the transition relation for the abstract state space until you either, you know, loop back on yourself or you reach some sort of halting state where you're done. And once you've got this graph back, you can extract an answer from it. And just to give you an example of what these things can actually look like in practice, and how nasty they can get, this would appear to be a straightforward doubly nested loop that happens to involve some higher orderness. But just happening to involve a little higher orderness and then throwing it at zero CFA gives you a graph that looks like this. So, you know, if you want to do anything reasonable with this, you can't do much. You certainly can't do any reasonable model checking once you get back something like this. So this is why it's important to understand CFAs, understand which CFAs do well in certain contexts. You know, zero CFA is mostly just fast, and that's why people use it. It's not particularly good at anything. So you have to know which one to use. But I will show you some techniques probably tomorrow or on Monday for how you can use a zero CFA-like analysis with some other techniques to actually pack a state space like this back down, or a graph like this back down. So what we'll do first is derive a zero CFA for continuation passing style. And the reason I like continuation passing style for deriving CFAs is it's very simple. You know, and the evaluation order is fixed, so you don't have to worry about non-determinism. All the arguments are atomic, or as Olivier called them, pure and total, so you don't have to worry about diverging or side effects. And in CPS, control is reified as data. So there is no difference between control flow and data flow analysis. They are effectively the same thing. So the grammar I typically operate with is just a multi-argument CPS grammar. We've got variables. An expression is a variable or a lambda term, and it means it's atomically valuable. If I tell you to tell me in the context of an environment what a variable or a lambda term becomes as a value, you can tell me right away. If it's a lambda term, you make a closure. If it's a variable, you look it up. But you don't have to worry about diverging. You're not going to do any side effects. And in a lambda term, the body has to be a call site. So once you invoke a lambda term, it's never going to return. So you actually, I take it back. For higher orders, all you need is to be able to accept procedures as arguments. Once you've got that, you can do CPS, and CPS is certainly a higher order language. And then a call site is pretty standard. So the initial concrete state space we're going to use is actually very simple. It's just got two components. It's got a call site and an environment in which to evaluate that call site. And an environment is a map, partial map, from variables into closures. Because the only values we've got right now are closures. And a closure is a lambda term paired with an environment. So this is all we need right now to get off the ground with a CPS-based CFA. So what we'll do is I'll state the concrete semantics, and then we'll abstract into the abstract semantics. So I mentioned you have to be able to inject from a program into the state space, and that's what this function I does. You give it a call, it's going to give you back an initial state, and all it does is it takes the call and it pairs it with the empty environment, the empty map. The concrete semantics itself really only consists of this transition relation. This transition relation just gets you from one state to the next. In this semantics, it happens to be deterministic. It's not strictly necessary, but it certainly makes some of the math easier. And it's going to use a helper function, this expression evaluator. This expression evaluator will take an expression to evaluate and an environment to evaluate it against. It's going to give you back a closure. So for the expression evaluator, if you give it a lambda term, it's just going to close the lambda term with whatever environment you gave it. If you give it a variable, it's just going to look up the variable. So this is just a helper function. And then another thing I like about CPS is, the semantics are always just, they're so simple. There's one rule, and it's four lines. And we've got the semantics, the entire concrete semantics. So if we're evaluating some call in the context of an environment, then what we're going to do is look up the function we're invoking at this particular call site in the context of the current environment. This is going to give us back a closure over some lambda term. And the body of that lambda term is obviously where we're headed next. So this call site is where we're at for the next state. It's also going to give us back the environment that it was closed over. So the next thing we're going to do is evaluate all of the arguments to this particular application point and get back closures for them. Next, we're going to take the environment out of the closure, not off the call site, because we want lexical scoping, and extend that environment so that the variables bound by this lambda term are bound to the closures we've evaluated as arguments to this particular call site. We take that environment and we tack it on to the call site, and that's our transition. That's all we had to do. So we're calling that zero CFA is effectively lambda flow analysis. When we want to abstract this, we're just going to throw away the environment from closures and just leave them as lambda terms. And this is going to guide us in constructing the abstract version or the abstract interpreter version of zero CFA. This is not the cleanest way to get zero CFA. We'll see the cleanest way tomorrow when we do KCFA and then back solve for zero CFA. The abstraction here is a little bit funky, but I just want to show that you can do it directly from this simple CPS-based semantics. So in the abstract state space, you'll notice that an abstract closure is just a lambda term. We've lost the environment. Now, an environment is a map from variables into power sets, or it's a map from a variable into a set of closures. So this is, if you remember the signature on flows2, that's what this is right here. It's basically flows2. And then we have one environment that summarizes all the environments anywhere in the program, or anywhere in the current concrete state. So an abstract state is a call site paired with this one globalized environment. So the abstraction function in this case will take a closure and just throw away the environment. On a state, it's going to leave the call site the same and then run the abstraction on the environment itself. And the only thing that's weird about this, and this is the awkward part about this particular direct abstraction, is that to abstract the environment at the top level, what it's going to do is range over all the environments it could somehow reach through the environment that gets passed in. So it's going to look up over. It's going to look at its range. It's going to get back some closures. It's going to get back some. It's going to pull the environments out of those closures, and then it's going to repeat this process over and over and over again until it's found all the environments that it can reach from this particular environment. And when you want to abstract something, it's going to take the variable and look it up in all of the environments and join them all together, or union them all together in this case. So the abstraction function for KCFA is much more direct and a little less awkward than this. Again, it's only because I want to show you that it is, in fact, possible. So for the abstract injector, given a call site, you want to get back some initial abstract state. All it's going to do is take the call site and pair it with bottom. In the abstract semantics, as is usually the case, we'll very tightly mimic the concrete semantics. So we're just going to have this abstract transition relation, which will take us from one state to possibly multiple successor abstract states. And then we've got this helper function for evaluation. And again, the difference here is it's going to return a set of closures instead of a single one. So the helper function, if you give it a lambda term, just puts it inside a set and gives it back. And if you give it a variable, it just looks it up in the environment and gives you back the answer from that. And if you look at the abstract transition relation itself, it looks almost identical to the one we saw in the concrete. In fact, the primary differences are the fact that when you look up the function you're applying, you could get multiple things back now. So you have to have one subsequent state for everything you could get back. So that's why we have a membership rather than equality here. And down here we have a join, and I'll explain what the join means in a second. But just for visual impact, I want to show you the concrete and the abstract semantics side by side, just so you can see that they do in fact look almost identical. And so what this join operation is doing right here is it's not just overwriting, because if we overwrote, we wouldn't be monotonic. It's actually merging the current environment and the new environment together. So I don't want to go into partial order theory. I'm sure Patrick's going to do plenty of that. I'll just define exactly what join means for me as I use join. So to join two environments, you get back a new environment, whereby when you take in some value, it looks up that value in both of the original environments and then unions the sets that it gets back together. So that's all that's going on here. And the last obligation in any sort of anything like this that you do is to prove that it's sound. And as I mentioned, it's rather easy to do in a framework like this because all you're really doing is setting up this simulation right here. You're saying that if I've got a concrete state and I find that it can transition to some other concrete state, then I can also abstract this concrete state. And from here, I'm guaranteed to find some abstract transition, some successor in the abstract, such that this relationship is maintained, where the relationship in this case is abstraction composed with subsumption. And Patrick, I'm sure, will get into a lot more detail about what those exactly mean. But the proofs for this sort of stuff are pretty boring. If you actually want to see the proofs, let me know. I'll show you one of these proofs looks like. But if there's no interest, then we'll just skip right over them. So just to sort of recap what it's like to run something like Zero CFA, the way it looks like is this. Or you can imagine it like this. Later on, I'll tell you how it's actually run. But conceptually, this is what you're doing. You've got your call site, and you're injecting it into the initial state. In this case, you just pair it with bottom. And you have that abstract transition relation, which you just explore starting from that initial state. And once you, loop back or hit some sort of halting state for all the states, you're done. And this is the reachable subset of the abstract state space. Now, this in and of itself is not a control flow analysis. A control flow analysis gives you back some sort of something like flows to. What this is doing is telling us all the states we could reach. So if you want to get the flow analysis back out of this, you have one more step to do, at least conceptually. Typically, you do this iteratively as you're running the analysis. But what you do is you join over all the reachable states, the environments within those states. And what you get back is exactly the flows to that you'd expect from a zero CFA. So now what we'll do is actually run through zero CFA on Omega. And the reason I like this is because it's got a very, very tiny abstract transition graph. So just to keep stuff from flowing off the page, lam is defined to be lambda f dot ff, and this call site right here is just applying that lambda term to itself. So if we inject that call site into an abstract state, we just get it paired with bottom. There's one transition we can make out of here, so we're just going to, you know, put this lambda term into there and immediately end up at f applied to f. And then if we take one step forward, we've got this lambda term flowing into here, and we end up back at f applied to f. So we're done. And if you, you know, range over all the reachable states, both of them, and join their environments together, this is what you get back for the flow set. It says that f flows to lam. So we can do a slightly more complicated example. So that example where I had v1 being bound to 3 and v2 being bound to 4, it turns out to be a pretty good example for differentiating how a lot of CFAs behave. So if we extend CPS with let, it's not too hard, I can give you a fairly direct encoding of that example in CPS, and we can see how an abstract interpretive CFA will behave on it. So to add let into CPS, of course you can only let an atomic value or a pure and total expression, as Olivier was referring to earlier. All you do is move into the body of the let, and you take the environment and update it so that the variable you're binding here gets the value to which the expression evaluates to. And the rule in the abstract looks effectively the same. The only difference, once again, is that we're joining so we don't throw anything away instead of overwriting. And then this is about the most direct encoding of that program for the original example that I can think of in CPS. So you do let binding on the lambda term for ID. And this, by the way, is what the identity function looks like in CPS. So in CPS, you take in an argument, but you also take in your continuation. And you invoke that continuation once you've got an answer. Well, in the identity function, you've got your answer right away. You just immediately invoke the continuation on the argument. And then for this call site, instead of let binding ID, we're actually calling this identity function on 3 and then passing in this lambda term as a continuation. So you know, if you sort of like put this over here, then it looks more like the example earlier. So you can think of CPS in some ways as sort of assembler written backwards, because you have the destination over here and the operation over here. And then this halt is just some unbound variable. So you can introduce an explicit halt form into CPS, but if a state has an unbound variable, that's by default a stuck or a terminating state. So that's a common way of, you know, simplifying the machinery but adding some sort of halting construct into CPS. So how will this behave for an abstract interpretive zero CFA? We're going to start off at that first call site with bottom. And then we're going to flow to the body of that call site, or of that let form, which is the second call site. But now we're going to have a binding for the identity function getting bound to the first lambda term. So, you know, the lambda term on the first line is lambda 1, this is lambda 2, and this is lambda 3. This state is going to invoke the identity function. So it's going to wind up in the body of the identity function after this, which is q applied to x. And two things got added to the environment as we did this. So if I maintained everything in the environments, it would sort of flow off the page. So all I'm going to give you is the changes to the environment between transitions. So at this point, q got the continuation from the call site over here. It got lambda 2. And x got the argument we passed in at that point. So x has 3. Now, when we invoke lambda 2, we're going to end up in the calls and the body of lambda 1. Sorry, but the body of lambda 2, which is ID applied to 4. So now we're at the third call site. And when we invoked this continuation, we ended up binding 3 to v1. So from here, we do another application of the identity function. Now notice what happened here. So because the environment kept growing monotonically, we now for the continuation have lambda 2 and lambda 3. So when this when this one returns, it's going to return to essentially this evaluation point and this evaluation point. So this is where some of that merging you saw earlier is coming from. Oh, and at the same time, X now has both 3 and 4. So when we return, we have two subsequent states. So if when we invoke lambda 3, we go straight to the halt state. We're done. But when we invoke lambda 2, we go back to here. So it looks like there's a loop in this program, even though there isn't. So this is the halt state. And what it's saying is that V2 could be 3 or 4. So again, you get that same imprecision of this particular halt state. But we have to continue investigating this branch, because we're not done yet. So on this branch, it's the same thing, except V1 now gets bound to 3 or 4. And then this one has one subsequent abstract state, where it's again invoking the identity function. And we again have two subsequent abstract states, because this also had the lambda or Q bound to both possible lambda terms. So one of the possible successors is actually a state we've already been to. So we actually loop back on the state space. And the other one is once again the halt, the halting state. So now we're finally done with this. And if you actually, joined over all the flow sets, then the flows to relation that you get back would look like this, which is the CPS translated version of what we got when we ran zero CFA with constraints over the earlier example. So I think that's good enough for today. You guys have any questions? It's basically all of zero CFA. Sure. I think it's down here. This one? Yeah. Yeah, and I will point out that I did play a little loose with the meaning of flows too. At one point I said it's a relation, other points I said it's a function. But the state spaces, or the sets are rather isomorphic. You can view them either way. Any other questions? Yep.
I think I missed a basic thing earlier. I apologize for this. But what do the k signify that the varying degree is zero through whatever?
Oh, so that's what we're going to get into tomorrow. I really didn't pin that down today. The short version is they determine context sensitivity, where context sensitivity differs in meaning a little bit between the imperative world and the higher order world. And what context sensitivity is determining is, how much history does a particular state remember, and how much history does it incorporate into the structure of its abstract environment.
Is this related to path sensitivity and anything in procedural data flow analysis, where we sort of talk about?
So there are.
Length one, length two.
Yes. There are relationships between flow sensitivity, path sensitivity, context sensitivity. There are relations between all of these concepts. You can generate some of one from the other in some cases. And tomorrow I think we'll see more of that with KCFA and its kin. Yeah, but the reason zero CFA is called zero CFA is because if you start with KCFA and you set K equals zero, the semantics, or the abstract semantics, degenerates into what we now call zero CFA. Though, KCFA isn't actually all that useful beyond zero CFA. I don't know of any compiler that actually implements one CFA because it's so expensive. All right. Well, if there are no more questions, I think we're almost out of time. Okay.